When my mom was studying at Indiana University in the late 1940s, 80% of her courses were required. That sounded high to me, and I asked her about it, and she said, you know, I didn't think a thing about it, because even though some of the courses were hard or boring or it wasn't clear exactly why they were required of the major, I just trusted that, gosh, these were the deans and the faculty with the PhDs, and they had mastered the field, and so surely they would know which courses to take. That was so long ago. Today, in a lot of colleges, the 80% has exactly flipped, and instead of 80% of the coursework being required, there are many programs where about 80% of the coursework is elective. And that's because, as scholars say, around 1960, there was this massive transition in our culture from the institution to the individual, from the experts to the self, from them to me. And so every incoming freshman today thinks, does he or she not, why would I let those people make the call? I'm the one who's paying the tuition dollars. I will choose the courses that I want to take. And now that individual self who has been so empowered has also been weaponized with social media. So if that educational experience is not up to the liking of that freshman, they will go on rateyourprof.com and they will shame and publicly punish you for having the gall to give them, say, a challenging assignment, whatever it may be. Okay. So what has happened in our culture, friends, is this profound change in which the self has become sovereign. The U.S. is one of only two countries in the world, in which the pharmaceutical companies advertise or market medications that are prescription medications direct to the consumer. And Big Pharma spends $5 billion every year on that. And you go, well, that's insane. What a waste of ad dollars. Why would you spend $5 billion telling somebody, say, to get Ambien or Lipitor when they cannot write themselves a script for a big bottle, even if they like your ad? I love those ads too, don't you? They always have the video montage of the senior couple playing tennis, and then there's this low voiceover. May cause irreversible brain damage and early death, you know? But you'd think that would be idiotic. Why are you advertising to someone who cannot act on it? Because they know that in our culture, the patient has the power. And that the power that was in the hands of the doctors and the hospital has largely shifted. Not completely, but to a great degree. And it is a rare doctor who will have the chutzpah to say, I don't think that fits your symptoms. I'm not going to prescribe that med that you just saw on TV. Okay. My favorite news story of the last month was this one. Maybe you saw this too. On January 28th, a woman at Newark Airport tried to get on a flight from Newark to LA and wanted to bring her emotional support peacock named Dexter. Okay, well, United, that unfeeling corporate conglomerate that it is, said no. Maybe it's because peacocks have a wingspan of 5 feet. Maybe it's because they'd told her 3 times before she got to the airport, no. Maybe it was because year over year, they and every other airline have seen a 75% increase in what are called animal incidents, in which emotional support animals either pee or poop or bite passengers. There was one case where a 70-pound dog attacked a passenger. And so the airlines are now starting to set some boundaries around that. But when we hear a news story like that, even though we kind of wink at Dexter because we don't have a peacock, our immediate emotional support as Americans today is not with the institution. It's with the individual. Okay. So we live, friends, in the United States of self. It does not seem at all ludicrous to us that, for example, at my daughter's high school where she teaches, a 14-year-old adolescent should be the one to help evaluate the quality of the pedagogy. That doesn't seem ludicrous to us. It doesn't seem ludicrous to us that people have brought on emotional support ducks and pigs and tried to get peacocks and turkeys Because in all of these cases, what we want to make sure that the self is expressed. And so then, when you and I come to a text like tonight's text, Mark 8 and verse 34, we hardly know what to do with it. Then Jesus called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves." You have to deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. That sounds so foreign to our ears. That is so far off in the distance from us culturally that we can hardly see it any longer. And so I want to back up tonight and say and talk about this teaching of Jesus Christ, which is so central to his teachings, and approach it step by step. So I have four questions and answers about this teaching, and let me set them out for you because I hope you may have them as well. Question number one, do I really have to deny myself? The answer is no. But if you want to be a follower of Jesus Christ, the answer is yes. Jesus said, whoever wants to be my disciple, if you're in that category, you must deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Now, just in case we think this is sort of poetic and a metaphoric expression merely, Jesus takes this phrase, deny yourself, and immediately makes it physical and brutal. Take up your execution stake, is the Greek, and follow me. So you cannot climb over these words. You can't kind of burrow under them or sneak your way around them. If you are going to have any interest in following Jesus Christ, you're going to have to face directly into these words right here and do something with them. All right. Well, question number two then would be, what exactly does deny yourself mean? What does it mean? Well, it's more challenging than you would think to answer. If you study the Bible commentaries on this passage, as I've been doing this week, they have this amazing propensity to say, when Jesus says deny yourself, it means we have to deny ourselves. That's really powerful insight. Thank you for that. Okay, so let's start with what it does not mean. St. Augustine said in the 4th century, well, it obviously does not mean that you physically kill yourself. The God who commanded thou shalt not kill is not interested in anyone's suicide. Don't ever think that. So obviously it doesn't mean that. I think we all would understand that. It also, though, does not mean to squelch your personality. Deny yourself does not mean squelch your personality. Now, maybe you're introverted and you grew up in a church where it was very important that Christians be evangelistic and talk about their faith, and you feel vaguely guilty that you think that's awkward and you don't like it and you don't do it much, right? Or maybe you have a naturally boisterous personality. You're kind of larger than life and you're always feeling like, oh, Christians are supposed to be meek and circumspect or something like that. And so you feel vaguely guilty. No, you are fearfully and wonderfully made, the Bible teaches. So your temperament in its basic shape is God's first gift to you. And you have to work within that framework. So deny yourself does not mean that, at least not so far as I can see. Nor does it mean deny yourself the enjoyment of basic and normal, healthy life pleasures, right? So various Christian holiness teachings have gone off right here, right? And have forgotten that verse that God gives us all things richly to enjoy. It's not a sin to want to wear up-to-date clothing, right? Or to go see a movie or have a glass of wine with dinner. God gives us all things richly to enjoy. So deny yourself does not mean to deny yourself the basic warm pleasures of life. So here's what I think it means. This is my working hypothesis. And I think it has, as is so often true with the teachings of Jesus, layers of meaning. So see if this makes sense to you. It has at least two layers of meaning. At the top layer, it certainly cannot mean less than that you must deny the natural desires of yourself that are tainted by selfishness. Okay? So it's denying that part of me that I express at your expense. So it's not even so much that what I want is wrong, but I'm so much wanting it that I want it in a way that it causes you distress of one kind or another. Okay? So there's many examples. I'll just give you a few. One is that laziness that sets in and says, I would be fine if you do all your work and also some of mine. I think I deserve that. You may have seen that with some colleagues in the workplace. John Ortberg has a great strategy for dads who have an infant at home that's getting up at night. He says, when the baby starts to cry, you say, I'll get it, I'll get it. But then don't get it. And then the baby will cry again. You go, no, I got it. And then finally, when your wife gets frustrated with you and says, doggone it, I'll get it, and gets up, then you go, no, I got it. Because that way, you get credit for, like, intending to get up, but you don't actually have to get up. Okay? So John had some fun with that one in one message. You might take that to heart. But you get that, right? I mean, I want to sleep in, but I don't want you to think like I'm a lazy guy. Okay, next. Anger. I deserve better than this, and I'm going to let you know that, so you hurt the way that I do right now, plus a little bit more for punitive damages. So, for example, I saw on social media this person had posted on Facebook. They said, can you believe that I went to Starbucks this morning and the barista put the hole in the lid right along the seam of my cup so that when I took my first sip, some of the coffee dribbled down the cup? That person should be fired. Okay. Now, what has just gone on in this person? A drip of coffee on their hand has become, I will need to push this person out of their job, even though they need it to pay the bills. It's this insane part of us that rises up in moments like that. Okay, or how about greed? Not in the crazy greed, but just my resources are scarce, so I don't want to share my time, my knowledge, my money with you, because then I won't have enough. We all naturally feel that way to some degree. As you know, Karen's been recovering, and so I've had to be her gross motor skills because the docs have said no bending, lifting, twisting. Well, I prayed, Lord, give me the grace to take on certain things that I wasn't doing, and now I'm doing. And I found that actually the serving part wasn't hard. Where I began to squeal like a stuck pig was the lack of control over my time. And I was like, oh, wow. I was planning on using that time. And the worst was when I had a half a day set aside for a morning prayer retreat, and Karen said, well, before you take off, remember, you need to help me get through some things this morning to get ready, and then I also need you to do this, and I need you to do that. I'm like, I cannot be serving you. I'm over here trying to become more like Jesus. So, this self must be denied. It is this what seems reasonable taking care of myself, but if you're the other person on that expression of the self, do you feel loved? Do you feel honored? Do you feel cared for? No. And so that surely has to be denied, and it is that self that when it is not denied, I'll tell you where it leads. It leads to lawsuits. It leads to failed businesses. It leads to wrenching divorces. It leads to black lives that don't seem to really matter. It leads to all the problems that you see in our culture when that self does not get denied. And so that is surely part of what Jesus means. Now, what I think he's talking about even more so, though, in this text, and what is even more challenging to us is this, is the bottom layer of deny yourself, which is this. Deny not only your selfish desires, as I've just expressed, but deny even your good, natural, and normal desires if those are getting in the way of your absolute obedience and commitment to me. And that is challenging. So, for example, we all have a desire to be successful in life. We define success a little differently, each one of us, but we have that desire. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's led to a lot of creative and initiative and all these wonderful things. But what if Jesus is calling me to serve him in a way that actually either makes me a failure or makes me look like a failure? My family doesn't approve of my career choice. Whatever. My colleagues don't get why I do this or something like that. Then am I willing to give up this very natural, normal, and good desire to be a successful person because following Jesus may require that I lose that. Or say, the desire to be popular. We all want to be liked. Nobody wants to be trashed. I love to be liked. It's awesome. But what if following Jesus does not permit that? And that, in fact, it brings people who misunderstand you and talk about you. Living a long life, nothing wrong with that. But following Jesus is not a guarantee of that. That's what I think deny yourself means. And that's where we all take a deep breath. All right, question three. Okay, so how would I go about actually denying myself? I'm going to offer some pastoral suggestions on this. Jesus just says, do it, and moves on. And so I've tried to unpack as best I can how I at least can try to implement that. One suggestion is this: accept deep in your bones that following Jesus will make your life harder, not easier. This is very hard for us as Americans to get. Do we really, really accept that following Jesus will make our lives harder, not easier? Now, there are joys, to be sure, right? There are blessings and benefits of the life in Christ. I'd never trade it. But it will make my life harder, and it will make yours. A friend of mine was telling me they saw an interview with the Swider-Peltz family here from Wheaton, who have been Olympic speed skaters. Mom Nancy was a generation ago. And then her two kids, Nancy and I think Brian, is it? Also are speed skaters. And here's what they go through, okay, to train to be an Olympian in speed skating. There's a morning practice of 3 to 4 hours. That's a lot of time. Then there's an evening practice of 3 to 4 hours. Then you have to eat 7,000 calories a day because you're burning off crazy amounts of calories out on the rink. Then you really cannot be holding any other job if you're going to be in serious training to compete in the Olympic Games. Then when you get to the Olympic Games, this is what actually got me the most, is you can't walk around and see the Olympic Village and hobnob with the other athletes before your race. Like from the time you land until you've finished all of your competitions, because you need every ounce of energy for the race. So what you see of much of the Olympic Games is what you can see outside your hotel room window. Now, imagine that Nancy was pulling aside her two kids and trying to interest them in becoming Olympic speed skater as she had. She'd say, I loved it. I loved appearing in four games. I loved setting records. I loved pushing myself to the extreme. I love the attention and the honor it brought and the chance to share my faith through that. I hope you'll do it. But you have to know there's a morning practice of 3 to 4 hours. There's an evening practice of 3 to 4 hours. You have to eat. And when Jesus does the same thing as that and says, I offer you immortality and eternal life and joy and forgiveness, but you have to know, if you're going to do this, you're going to have to deny yourself, take up your execution stake, and follow me. We all go, whoa, what happened? But Jesus is not asking us to do anything he has not done. Verse 31, Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man, that's a reference to himself, must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, meaning all the important people in the culture. Today we would insert like media. And that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. So Jesus is saying, that's the way I live my life. If you're going to follow me, you got to live the same kind of life I live. Now this is a real gut check, isn't it? It's like, how much do I love Jesus? Do I love Jesus as long as things are going reasonably well and I, or do I love Jesus enough to accept setbacks and denials to things that are actually good, normal, and I will always want if I could? That is challenging. Thomas A. Kempis in the 1400s said, and I don't think it's changed much, Jesus today has many who love his heavenly kingdom, but few who carry his cross. Plenty of people he finds to share his banquet, few to share his fast. There are many who follow Jesus as far as the breaking of bread, few as far as drinking the cup of suffering. Now today, as far as I can tell, America is shedding its Christianity about as quickly as it's possible to do so. Maybe that's a little severe, but you get the idea. You see the same cultural trends I do. But for me, this is an opportunity for believers who will obey Jesus and deny themselves the chance to shine brighter than ever. There is going to be a massive distinction between the cultural sort of Christian and the real follower of Jesus Christ, no kidding. And that will be eminently attractive, where everything is permitted, nothing is forgiven, and we just live in this crazy culture. And when you set somebody who says, I will follow Jesus Christ, period, that is going to be eminently attractive. Well, all right, so we have to accept that that's the reality of it. And then resist the reasonable temptations to look out for number one. And what I mean by that is not let our needs, no matter how legitimate, get in the way of obedience to God's call. This text is a tale of two rebukes. Did you see that? Verse 32, Jesus spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. Get behind me, Satan. You don't have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. I tried to imagine, what did Peter's rebuke of Jesus sound like? You know? Like, man, none of these other guys are going to step up and tell him the real deal. Like, I've got to do this one more time. I got to be the leader here. Okay, I'll be the adult in the room, and I'll pull him aside. I'll tell him what's what. And so did he appeal to Jesus' leadership? I mean, did he say, do you realize, like, you're really demoralizing people? Like, nobody's ever going to follow you. They will if you say your best life now, but if you're going to promise your worst death now, nobody's going to follow you. You know? Did he appeal to his knowledge of Scripture? Like, hey, have you not read in Daniel where it says the Son of Man is given dominion and authority? You should be given dominion and authority. Why are you talking about not suffering? You know, did he appeal to his compassion? People need you so much. You're the only one who can heal the eyes of a person born blind. And what? A dead Messiah does nobody any good. Now, you know what? All of those possible lines of reasoning are totally reasonable. And Jesus calls them satanic. Why so strong? Because it's the same reason Oswald Chambers says self-pity is satanic. It takes your eyes off of the need, the call, and the passion of God, and it puts it all on me. See? And Jesus says, my entire life is devoted to one thing. It's the will of the Father. And you're trying to get me to leave that behind, abandon my mission, fail the billions of people who are cut off, lost, and without hope, without God in this world, unless I die. And you're trying to dissuade me from that. That is satanic. I cannot listen to that for another second. So we have to learn how to resist these reasonable temptations. Every commercial is filled with them. It's crazy. We're saturated in it. God have mercy on us. All right, but now here's some lighter things. Let's start where we are, not where we aren't yet. I thought, am I willing to lay down my life for Jesus Christ? The answer is, I don't know. I'm really glad I've not been tested in that way, because I do have a fear in me that I might cave. I hope I don't. But I don't know. But I can't start there. I can't worry about there. All I can do is start right where I'm living. I can't start running the ultra marathons. I had to start with just a jog around Rice Lake track, you know? That's where I am. So we need to start small. We need to work with our daily lives and deny ourselves something in that context. We deny ourselves in small things to learn how to deny ourselves in medium things, to gain the strength to deny ourselves in large things. As Michael Card said, Jesus was many times a martyr before he died. He didn't just make the decision in Gethsemane. He made it over and over and over and over with all that he put up with and endured. So what would that look like? Well, it might be, I'm tired, but I'm going to listen to you right now. That is a death, that is a denial of the self. It's, I might fast a meal and pray. That is a denial of the self. I might use some money that actually I need, and I was going to use for this, but I'm going to give it to this other thing that I think furthers the purposes of God. That is a denial of the self. And these small actions build muscle. They build the muscle that says, I will follow you, Jesus, despite that. One thing I do that's actually been really helpful to me is I look over my calendar the night before, and I pray through it. So I don't just look at it to like figure out, why did you overschedule your day again? No, I don't. It's not that. Although sometimes it is that. But I pray. And it's interesting. Almost every time I see an appointment or a request or a task that has to be in that next day, and I feel a resistance when I think about why am I resisting that? Why am I not looking forward to that? Why am I dreading that? It's usually because somewhere in me there's some self rearing its head. That person hurt me a while back, and I haven't completely forgiven them. Or I know that this person can be draining. I don't want to let them drain me. Whatever it may be, right? You have those same things in your appointment calendar too. And so I pray, Lord, help me with that. Give me the grace for that. Help me deny this part of myself so that I can enter that moment with you and do what you've called me to do there. If we start small, we'll be ready for whatever God does give us. Now, final question, question 4. Wow, this is heavy. Is there any good news? Well, yes, there actually is. We focus on what we have to give up, but Jesus also tells us what we gain. Look at verse 35. Whoever wants to save their life, meaning live their life for their own pursuits, will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. This is amazing. What he means is he's saying, if you will do what I've just asked you to do, here's what has happened. You will have immortality. You will live forever. There's life in the presence of God, and it doesn't end. I just gave you the way out of death. Now, it's almost like he's saying, picture yourself standing on the highest step of the podium. Picture the medal being draped around your neck. Picture the applause and your name being remembered forever. Now, go to the ice rink at 5 a.m. And he's saying, I promise you life, immortality, glory, honor in the presence of the Father. But it requires denial. Now, the alternative, though, is so much worse. Whoever wants to save their life will lose it. Verse 36, what good is it if you get the whole world, which is what we all natively want, yet forfeit your soul? What can anyone give in exchange for your soul? You can be Jeff Bezos and have $150 billion, depending on the day in the market. And when Jeff dies, what's he going to do to get his soul back? He ain't got no options. He can take all $150 billion and pay the Cryonics Institute to put his body in deep freeze in hope that someday medicine will get to the point where it can bring his body back out. That's the best he's got. He ain't got nothing. But you follow Jesus, you have life, immortality, and glory forever. Now, let's apply this, friends. If you're here tonight, and it may very well be in a group of this size, that you're thinking about committing yourself really intensively to Jesus Christ, either for the first time or kind of a recommitment at this new place in your life. Can I tell you something? There is no fine print in the contract. Jesus takes the hardest thing and puts it in big bold letters right up at the top. Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. It's right there. If you want to follow him, that's going to be part of it. I urge you to do it. Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, the life. But you need to know that. Now, some of you, you're struggling with why is the Christian life so hard? And I feel really bad about this because honestly, some of you were really, you had preaching malpractice. You were told about all of the benefits of following Jesus and few, if any, of the cost. You were told it would make you happy and it would make your marriage better and life would be amazing and all this stuff. And on behalf of that bad preaching, I have to say I'm really sorry. That is not the teaching of Jesus Christ. The teaching of Jesus Christ could not be plainer. But it's good. And it's true. And it's right. So, may he give you grace to bear what you're bearing, and may you know that if you lose your life for his sake, you will find it. You'll gain it forever. Now, last, here's the question that I've been pondering, and I offer to you to ponder too. What is the good and natural desire that I have right now that is preventing me from following Jesus with everything I've got? If we lose our life for Jesus Christ, we'll find it. Amen. Father, this is a word that you must empower us to live. We don't have it in ourselves. And we cry out to you for the grace, the courage to do what really our hearts are longing to do when we hear you call, which is follow you. Help us, Lord, in our weakness. Make us strong and give us the grace to follow you.